Following are some comments on Thomas Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy for week one. Kidd, Marlowe, Johnson, Webster, and Shakespeare as colleagues. Since this course is about four of Shakespeare's contemporaries, the obvious question is, did Shakespeare in fact know these men? Well, except for Ben Jonson, we don't have evidence that any of the other three met Shakespeare. Some scholars say that Kidd and Thomas Nash wrote the play that Shakespeare later adapted to become Henry VI, Part 1. Others, such as Douglas Brewster, believe that Shakespeare contributed 300 lines to the Spanish Tragedy, though this would have been done for the 1602 quarto, after Kidd died. Marlowe and Shakespeare may have worked together on parts of the Henry VI plays. Today's methods of attribution are sophisticated, and they go far beyond the old-fashioned concordances so admirably compiled by earlier scholars. But they will probably never be able to provide the certainty we would like in such matters. So, on the specific issue of whether Shakespeare ever met Marlowe or Kidd, we just don't know. There's no evidence either way. There's also no reason to insist that they didn't get together at some point. They could have. The London playwriting scene was fast-moving, competitive, even intimate, so it's hardly implausible to suppose that Shakespeare met a good number of his fellow playwrights. Still, we'll probably never know for certain. In any case, the important thing is that Kidd and Marlowe surely influenced Shakespeare's work because of their success. They blazed a trail for him, and he took advantage of their efforts. It is a pity that both Kidd and Marlowe died so young and on the cusp of brilliant careers in drama. Shakespeare enjoyed more time to perfect his art. Who knows what heights Marlowe, in particular, would have reached if he hadn't been stabbed to death in May 1593 at the age of 29. With regard to Ben Jonson, the record isn't such a blank. Shakespeare did know the talented and imposing Jonson pretty well. They're widely thought to have met, at least occasionally, at the local Mermaid Tavern in London. Shakespeare's company produced a couple of Jonson's plays, too. Every Man in His Humor and Sejanus His Fall. And Shakespeare seems to have acted a role in at least the first-mentioned play. In his critical study Timber or Discoveries, written after Shakespeare's passing, Jonson recalls suggesting that his friend could have done a better job of editing his own work, but he takes care to dampen the claim that he meant to diminish him thereby. This is a long quote. "I remember the players have often mentioned it as an honor to Shakespeare that in his writing, whatsoever he penned, he never blotted out a line. My answer hath been, would he had blotted 1,000, which they thought a malevolent speech." Ellipsis. "He was indeed honest and of an open and free nature, had an excellent fancy, brave notions and gentle expressions, wherein he flowed with that facility that sometime it was necessary he should be stopped." Ellipsis. "His wit was in his own power, would the rule of it had been so too." Ellipsis. "But he redeemed his vices with his virtues. There was ever more in him to be praised than to be pardoned." The text is from Hathitrust. It's in the public domain, page 23, Gin and Company, edited by Felix E. Schelling, 1892. If the worst you can say of an artist is that his imagination sometimes ran away from him, that isn't so bad, is it? As for John Webster, we don't know a lot about his life. He died sometime between 1626 and 1634. That's quite a range. I don't think it's known whether he ever met Shakespeare, but Shakespeare in Love has an interesting fictional encounter between young master Webster and Shakespeare, in which the boy says boldly that blood-drenched plays like Titus Andronicus are right up his alley. Quote unquote, "Plenty of blood, that's the only writing." Ralph Fiennes's Will Shakespeare seems a bit taken aback by this meeting. In any case, Webster was an extraordinary artist, as anyone familiar with the Duchess of Malfi can attest. And so on to a little more biographical information about Thomas Kidd. He was born in early November 1558 and died by December 1594. He was just short of 36 when he died, probably from injuries inflicted by state torture, but more on that in a moment. Thomas was the son of a scrivener and attended the Merchant Taylor's School in London, which must have been an excellent experience since some of its pupils went on to become important figures in the ranks of English society. When Thomas Kidd was in attendance, the headmaster was the well-regarded Richard Mulcaster. Kidd may have had as his patron Lord Ferdinando Strange, whose acting company was respected in Elizabethan London. In any case, Kidd was on the way up with his hit play, The Spanish Tragedy, which got the Senecan revenge tragedy genre going strong on London stages. The play was apparently written sometime during the mid-1580s, though it wasn't entered into the official stationer's register until 1592. It was performed many times by several acting companies. Kidd probably also wrote the so-called Hamlet that Shakespeare seems to have used as a basis for his own Hamlet in 1601. He also wrote Cornelia, a translation of a French play, and Soliman and Perseida, a romantic tragedy. Brian Vickers also attributes to Kidd the domestic tragedy Arden of Faversham, the Shakespeare source text King Lear, L-E-I-R, and the love triangle-based comedy Fair M. As for the sad ending of Kidd's life, the playwright roomed with Christopher Marlowe in the early 1590s, and in May of 1593 he was taken into custody and subjected to torture because the authorities thought he was involved in treason. In his lodgings were found Marlowe's copy of a treatise by an earlier author denying Christ's divinity. Kidd later denounced Marlowe's blasphemous expressions in a letter to the Lord Keeper of the Great Seal, Sir John Puckering, and seems never to have fully recovered from the torture inflicted on him. He died by the end of 1594, thus cutting short what was already beginning to be a brilliant career. Marlowe himself died at the end of May 1593. Another great career ended prematurely. The revenge genre and theme. By way of preparing to study Kidd's masterpiece, The Spanish Tragedy, we should reflect on the theme of revenge. It's appropriate to begin with some comments about the classical underpinnings of the Elizabethan and Jacobean penchant for revenge tragedies. Homer and Aeschylus will serve us well in this regard. First, Homer. In the Odyssey, you'd think that once Odysseus makes it back home, to his beloved island kingdom of Ithaca, and slaughters all those arrogant and disrespectful suitors to his wife, Penelope, that would be the end of the story. But it isn't. In the 24th and final book, the relatives of these well-to-do suitors band together and come at Odysseus seeking revenge, which is their right as family members. Things get so far out of hand that Athena has to step in and put an end to the fighting, which she does. Only then do we get the happy outcome we have come to expect from an epic that is, after all, essentially comic in spirit. In Aeschylus's tragic trilogy, The Oresteia, the terrifying Furies who pursue Orestes for taking revenge against his mother Clytemnestra, who killed his father King Agamemnon, are renamed the Eumenides, the well-abiding, and then given a place of honor under the city of Athens. The point is that these creatures who personify revenge don't really go away. There they are, guaranteeing, one might even say underwriting in the contractual sense, the glorious civic and legal order that has been newly founded in Athens. The god Apollo is instrumental in the achievement celebrated by the play, just as Athena helps Odysseus out of his predicament near the end of the Odyssey. We could mention many more instances in which revenge figures prominently in Greek and Roman plays and literary works. Just to name one, we have Ovid's stories taken from the Greeks and transformed into matter for the Metamorphoses. Procne and Philomel is a blood-curdling tale of revenge that Shakespeare adapts in his popular over-the-top revenge play, Titus Andronicus. He knew his copy of Ovid quite well. There's also the Roman Stoic philosopher and tragedian Lucius Annaeus Seneca, usually just called Seneca, who wrote gory plays like Thyestes, wherein murder and cannibalism are both on the menu. King Atreus of Argos is enraged at his brother Thyestes, who stole his wife and throne. When Atreus is restored to the throne, he pretends to invite Thyestes back to share power. But outside the palace, he kills Thyestes' three sons and serves them to him at a sumptuous dinner, thus inflicting the worst of all insults on anyone with dynastic interests, forcing him to swallow his own increase. Seneca is especially useful to us because his status as a philosopher reminds us that although revenge tragedies are often gory and outrageous, as much as any tragedy, they have serious philosophical underpinnings. Revenge plays reinforce the sense of life's sometimes fiendish complexities and confoundings. They deal with the great question of justice in human relations, with the frailties of human nature, and with the infuriating tendency of civilization to set itself up as our protector, and then to end up being an engine of dishonesty and oppression. In the case of Seneca's Atreus and Thyestes in his revenge masterpiece, Thyestes, the two royal brothers really are driven by a kind of blind, stupid rage to do what they do. In Homer, this blind, stupid rage is called atasthalie. You can spell that A-T-A-S-T-H-A-L-I-E. As Homer says at the outset of the Odyssey, it's just the thing that causes Odysseus' crew to kill and eat the sun god Hyperion's sacred cattle, thus delaying the trip home to Ithaca. It seems as if a person is always thrown into an always already terrible situation and driven to do dreadful things or take on shattering responsibilities. Remember the Doors song, Riders on the Storm? There's a pair of lines in it that run, quote-unquote, "Into this world we're thrown like a dog without a bone." Yes, that feeling seems integral to the protagonists in revenge tragedies. Then too, very often, the characters in the ancient revenge tales are generationally accursed. They're not really even acting from their own agency. And if that's so, perhaps their tragedy is to be born into an accursed house. A kind of wild justice, revenge in Shakespeare's own age. Closer to our own time comes Sir Francis Bacon's canny description of revenge as, quote-unquote, but a kind of wild justice, that if society indulges it, putteth the law out of office, quote-unquote. Here's a longer version of the quote from the relevant essay Of Justice in Bacon's Essays Civil and Moral, quote-unquote, "Revenge is a kind of wild justice, which the more man's nature runs to, the more ought law to weed it out. For as for the first wrong, it doth but offend the law, but the revenge of that wrong putteth the law out of office." Bacon is right to identify how dangerous, even explosive, revenge is to the civic order. That's the essential point Aeschylus and Homer were making in the ancient texts we have already considered. Bacon is implying that a long revenge-based cycle would soon generate a great deal of death and destruction. How can anything be built up in such circumstances and not be torn down again almost immediately? However does one promote a civilization while that is happening? Still, revenge is interesting to most people because it's something that everybody understands. Thus, the ubiquitousness of it as a plotline in plays and narratives, or a subplot in films. At the personal level, the intense desire for revenge isolates people in their own individual hell. But at the same time, it calls forth whatever they have within them so it can be marshaled against a clever, ruthless, or powerful enemy. Revenge may begin as a private affair, but it tends to spill out into the public realm, with very public and political consequences. So, in a sense, revenge tragedy delves into the consequences of a profound misdirection of intense, irrepressible human energies. What can we say in general about Elizabethan revenge plays? The engine of these plays is basically the same as for the ancients, namely, outrage at a murder that's been committed or some great wrong or insult given, which then proves difficult to repay, thanks to the revenger's need to work within an intricate, corrupt, courtly society, a veritable maze comprised of human fears, delusions, pretensions, Machiavellian scheming, and unhealthy desires. One can't just do something like take revenge and be done with it. Serious obstacles invariably present themselves, and the consequences of taking revenge are sure to be lethal for the revenge taker as well as the person suffering the revenge. Modern Christian revenge, we should also note, is against Judeo-Christian doctrine, which posits that vengeance belongs to God, not mortals. See Deuteronomy 32:35 and Paul's epistle to the Romans 12:19 and elsewhere in that text. But frankly, and with only a partial exception for Hamlet, not too much need be made of that fact. And with only a partial exception for Hamlet, not too much need be made of that fact, since in the end, revengers will have their revenge, and audiences must have their bloody scenes to enjoy. It has even been argued that Christianity makes the whole concept of tragedy moot, but that's another matter for another discussion. Some critics have suggested that in revenge tragedies, an anxious and frustrated public could more or less safely indulge their fantasies of freeing themselves from the clutches of an entrenched authoritarian political regime, which would be an accurate description of the courts of the absolute monarchs who ruled during Shakespeare's lifetime, Elizabeth I and James I. Though beloved by many of their subjects, both of these sovereigns exercised enormous and, for some, terrifying power over the citizenry of early modern England. Revenge plays offered an aesthetic means of coping with tensions concerning religion, state power, and other serious matters. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Thursday, May 29th, 2025. The foregoing material, excepting quotations, is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake.